Welcome to the Ask Sensei Tony podcast, where Sensei will address your questions about life from a cosmic perspective. Please subscribe and ask a question at AskSenseiTony.com to find out more about studying with Sensei privately, becoming a part of our spiritual community, and training to become a mindful minister of oneness in our seminary. We hope you enjoy this episode and find it helpful.
Hi, this is Sensei Tony, and today's question is coming from Bill, and it is, I had a dream that I committed murder. What does that mean? So Bill committed murder in his dream. He's asking, what do I think that means? Well, I think in order for us to address this question, we have to kind of discuss what dreams are about. And as always, I'm going to start from the cosmic perspective, which is going to look at dreaming as a natural process of our evolutionary history. Animals dream. It's very clear that they do. Not just from, you know, anecdotal observation, you know, where you see your pet sort of, you know, you can tell they're dreaming, you know, because they'll make noises or maybe they'll be kind of moving in a certain way. And there's also been research that shows that animals have dream states. And so this becomes something that becomes more highly evolved in human beings. One of the fascinating things about dreams, what we know from science, is that there are some creatures that don't experience what we would call rapid eye movement REM sleep state. Insects don't seem to have that, and fish don't seem to have that. However, mammals certainly do. And it seems that reptiles may as well. And of all those species that do dream, infants seem to dream the most. And animals like dogs, for example, seem to dream the same way humans do, but they seem to cycle through much faster than we do. You know, the various sleep cycles. And it's possible, some scientists believe that the dreaming aspect is something actually that holds over from the reptilian brain, the reptilian sort of ancestry, and that the reason that infants dream more than adults is because they're creating new neural sensory connections, because the brain is really developing and growing at that point and continues to up until probably somewhere around age 25. And so it's, you know, doing that. So that might be one purpose that dreaming serves, is to create new neural networks. In adults, dreaming seems to be very much connected to memory areas of the brain. And there are a lot of different theories out there. The one that makes the most sense to me is that dreams are made up of bits of information that, you know, get through that that filtering part of the brain. You know, we talked about the reticular activating aspect of the brain, which filters out everything but fear and novelty. And I think that sometimes the stuff that gets repressed ends up being processed by the brain and the body. And that could be part of the explanation, which will lead me into another sort of deeper way that I look at it. The other thing is, we do know that some kinds of foods we know now that, for example, that, you know, it's hard to describe where the mind is. We've always associated with the brain, but we also know now that in the gut, that we have just as many neurotransmitters, some of them more than we do in the brain. And so, you know, the foods we eat could have, you know, and we've all had that experience, you know, which is echoed in that famous line from A Christmas Carol, where Scrooge says, "There's more of gravy than the grave of you." And there's some truth to that, because of the fact that the system is all interdependent. So how do we work in the four direction system of mindfulness? How do we work with dreams? Well, what we do is we understand all the scientific understandings of and knowledge of things, and we accept that, and we find that as an interesting way to sort of enter in. But then I would go to the place where I would say that, along with this concept that some of the press material or excess material that doesn't get integrated by the filtering part of the brain or mind, that repressed stuff, which we would also use the expression unconscious, although unconscious can just simply mean that you've been so conditioned by habit that you do something automatically. I would also say that it's possible that when we repress things, and now let me explain the difference between repression and, for example, suppression, because I advocate temporary suppression sometimes. So let me give you the, without going into the whole model of that, and if you want to learn more, please get my book, Free Your Mind, The Four Direction System of Mindfulness, or my new book, The Three Principles of Oneness, How Embodying the Cosmic Perspective Can Liberate Your Life. I go into great detail about this, but essentially, when we look at what suppression is an intentional, conscious thing that we're doing. And repression, in the way I'm defining it, is an unconscious, unintentional sort of pushing something out of awareness. And like I said, I advocate for temporary active suppression. Now, the example I always give that's really simple is that if you get home from work on Wednesday and there's a whole bunch of bills on your desk, and you say, "Okay, I'm going to put them in the drawer, file them away, and then I'm going to, on Sunday, I'll open them up, or Saturday, I'll open them up, and then I'll go through them and take care of them." That's active suppression, where you're temporarily putting something aside because you don't need to deal with it at this moment, and you have other things that you want to focus on. Now, if on the weekend, if I don't ever open that drawer, or I don't ever go through the bills and take care of them, then that can then move from being suppression into repression. But more accurately, repression would be no intention whatsoever, because I think the first example I give is more about procrastination. But repression is more of a, I mean, I think they're linked, but repression is more of an unconscious thing you're doing, where you just forget something, right? Something was very important, something you needed to do, but you seem to block it out. And repression, I think, is a part of the ego self's incredible ability to protect us and protect the ego and protect the identity that we develop and associate as me. And it's very sophisticated in some ways. Some ways it's very simple, in other ways it's very sophisticated. The defense mechanisms that we learn as a child, they tend to have a very rudimentary sort of primal way of being. But as we become adults, that defense mechanism can become more sophisticated. Where, as children, it might have been something we did as a reaction to the environment. As adults, repression is probably the accumulation of lots of experiences around a particular subject. And so it becomes part of our pattern. Whereas I think when we're children, it's more of a reaction stage, But as adults, it becomes more a part of the pattern of our conditioning. So when we have a dream, and in this case, like Bill's example, where I do something that maybe horrifies me, or something that just really confuses me, or, you know, scares me, whatever. In this case, dreaming of killing someone. So the first thing I would say is that in my experience, dreams have two sort of aspects to them. One is that a dream can be a sort of repressed wish fulfillment. So, like, for example, I don't really like this person. I'm annoyed with them. I feel that maybe they're trying to harm me, what have you. And so I've been conditioned to be a nice person and to not be violent. And so in my dreams, because the energy I feel around, the aversion I feel around this person is so strong, I could conjure up a wish fulfillment that I wouldn't carry out in real life, but that I, my ego would like to do. And so, and that is what, you know, we call wish fulfillment. And so I think that's one thing. And the thing that's important to realize is that dreams really are like thoughts. So from a mindfulness perspective, we don't treat our thoughts, feelings or sensations as our identity. We treat them as experiences that we're having, and we learn in meditation to observe without judgment those experiences so that we become less reactive. And there's this great, there are great expressions for this within the Buddhist tradition, but it's being mindful is the basic line. And so a dream doesn't mean anything unless I act on it, right? And it doesn't say anything about me per se. It's just the working out of my normal human mind. So the first thing I would say is that for Bill, that a dream of killing someone could be a type of repressed wish fulfillment, where maybe this is a person that you really don't care for, and you know, you would never harm someone in real life, but your ego is so troubled by it that it offers you up some wish-fulfilling imagery. That's one thing. Important thing to realize is it doesn't say anything about you as a person or your character, or that you would really, you know, harm someone that way. It just means sometimes when the ego self gets so overwhelmed by aversion, that it will work itself out. And that's one of the things that's interesting about the human, is that, you know, once you accept our theory, which is that the mind is always seeking homeostasis, it's like other natural systems, it's seeking balance, you know. It's like the autonomic nervous system. The sympathetic and parasympathetic are always kind of yin and yang-ish, working out that dynamic. I think the same is true here. And so the second way of understanding why someone might have that kind of dream is not coming from a place of wish fulfillment per se, but it comes more from the fear of the aversion that you. So this is not so much that you have this aversion and you're repressing that information, and it's coming out in your dreams as wish fulfillment. In this case, you are actually afraid of the feelings you're having of aversion. And that fear of the aversion in your unconscious mind can actually make it so. Now, I don't want to get too complicated with this, but the brain and mind, body has a way of kind of doing certain things with fear. So, for example, when I've worked with people that have suffered from obsessive compulsive disorder or maybe obsessive thought disorder, often, we think of it in terms of counting or you have to touch certain things, But there's also the type of thought disorder, which is very common, where people have horrifying images. And in my book, Free Your Mind, I give an example of a woman I worked with who went through this horrific experience of, having obsessive thoughts about harming her child. Now, she had no desire to do that. She had never thought about that before. And the fact that it horrified her is what, clarified that this was something else going on. So I would suggest you read that book in that chapter. But in essence, what happened was is I worked with her physician to make sure that her hormonal balance was there. If there was any prior issues with anxiety or depression that were sincere, very serious, then I would maybe talk to the doctor about also using some sort of medication. But the biggest thing I did with her was help her to realize that these thoughts, first of all, when the brain gets in that kind of a loop situation with obsessiveness, and that takes place in the part of the brain that we call the amygdala. And if there's other aspects to that, which is like the cingulate gyrus and the caudate nucleus, when that happens, you think that you get kind of caught in a loop. And the more you think about it, I'm sorry, the more you try to avoid the thought, like, okay, I have this horror, like this poor woman is, she can't even, she gets to the point where she can't even touch her child because she's afraid if she touches the child will catch on fire. See, it's irrational. But there's this sense of things there, right? And she heard it in some way. So she can't even touch it. She got to a point where her sister had to actually come in and take care of her children. This was her second child. And so part of it is the brain, is just when it gets overloaded with this stuff, and sometimes a virus can trigger OCD. There's good evidence to show that sometimes a streptococcus and infection can cause it, and certain types of genetic preponderances can cause it, so that from the person has a sort of inherited orientation towards this particular issue. So you have to deal with that, and then you realize it. You talk about it in a crude way. I talk about it like brain. Brain farts, it's like it's something, it's like it's a secretion or something that's being created by this part of the brain overacting. And however, that's what I try to do from the scientific perspective is help the person understand what's going on so that they can realize that this doesn't mean anything, that it simply is the brain misfiring. However, I find that even if that's true, the imagery that the brain is using or the mind is using in this misfiring is usually related to the person's conditioning. And in this particular case, whenever I worked with her and we kind of got into things and I taught her to, observe the thoughts, the obsessive thoughts, as the experience she's having, but saying nothing about her personally and just sort of create a spaciousness with them. She started to develop less aversion to them. And so she could have the thoughts going on and, kind of be working on something else. And she said to me one time, it was like, there was like a TV show going over here with all these terrible, horrible, violent things going on. And then she was kind of focused on doing something else. But she was no longer reacting to it the same way. And along with the other modalities of therapy she was receiving, eventually they weakened. But I did tell her that, there's probably more to this in terms of the imagery it's using. And so when we got deeper into her conditioning and her childhood, we discovered that she had some really dark thoughts about herself. that she had been conditioned and taught certain things that made her believe that she was a bad person and that she was kind of a monster. And this came out of a combination of some bad religion and some unfortunate parenting. And she incorporated this very low sense of her own self-worth and that she would never be any good. And she had a tendency to blame herself for anything that went wrong, not just for herself, but people around her that she cared for. And so when you have that kind of conditioning buried down in it, you think you're a monster, you're a terrible person, you're no good, you don't deserve love. Then you combine that with this kind of misfiring in the brain. That's what we get. So the good news is she was able to successfully move into a place where the obsessive thoughts were no longer present. And she began to work through our system of mindfulness, and she started to develop a clear sense of her own self-worth inherently. And she was able to actually, she was able to resume caring for her children. And I've known her for quite a long time, actually. And she's doing very well. And she's never really been plagued by it, although I did tell her that if it ever does come back, where she starts to obsess again, don't be afraid of it because you understand it now. And that means you need to stop, look, and listen, which I took from an old Elvis Presley song. Stop, look, and listen. That's my philosophy. But I try to get people to use, discursive emotions or something like that kind of thought as a mindfulness bell to say, hey, I need to stop, look, and listen. Don't let it go. And once you do that, you can free yourself from it. And the same thing's true sometimes where it's not even mental, but it'll be physical manifestations of different types of pain and different types of ailments. So, how do we apply this to Bill's question? That there's a fear of your shadow. So, that's a simple way to say it, but what does that mean? So the shadow is a term that we use to talk about the repressed aspect of our psyche. And in the transpersonal model that we use, the shadow represents the early repression of all these types of material, and also can be the patterns of that material. And the shadow is a huge subject of which I have spoken of on another talk here through my YouTube and podcast channel. So I'd refer you back to that discussion because it's a big topic. But essentially, this is the fear of the shadow. And that's the other possibility, that besides it being a sort of repressed wish fulfillment, this could be a conscious fear of the shadow, like the woman I mentioned had a conscious fear of her thoughts. And so sometimes a conscious fear of the shadow will make thoughts that are horrible or terrifying become more present. An example of the woman that was coming through obsessive thoughts. And in this case, and I've actually had people actually have the same exact experience, so this is not that strange, Bill. You should know. Lots of people have dreams like this, and they would never ever harm someone intentionally, but they experience this. So, I wouldn't be able to really help you more than this without getting into one-on-one counsel together, but I can tell you that it's one of those two. If it's the wish fulfillment, then that just means you need to open up more about the aversion you have to this person and kind of work through that mindfully. If it's a fear of the shadow, then we have a little bit deeper work to do where you learn to accept parts of yourself that you've found unacceptable, or maybe you've been conditioned that that's so. And in that process, you learn to love each other, love yourself, and love yourself out of that space. So, in summary, first of all, don't be afraid. Fear not. It was always interesting to me when, in the Christian tradition, when the angels would appear, they weren't kind of like the pop figure, of this, somewhat beautiful human type character, but they were often terrifying figures. And so the first thing they would say is, "Fear not." Fear not. And in the Heart Sutra, the heart scripture within Buddhism, the ending of the liturgical version of the Heart Sutra, you have, "Do not be afraid, do not fear." And also in the crossing over ceremony, where you're helping someone to move on in terms of their consciousness, you always begin with, "Don't be afraid." Tibetan Book of Changes, or sometimes called Tibetan Book of Dead, of the Dead, you find that phrase. So first thing I would say is, don't be afraid. Because whatever thoughts or dreams you're having, they don't mean anything unless you act on them. So you have a choice. And I remember, the woman I mentioned earlier, I said, "Well, how about it, instead of you trying to push away that thought that if you touch your child, you would harm it, how about you ask yourself the question, would you harm your child?" And she said, "No, of course not." I said, "Well, then there you go. The rest of it's just stuff you have to work out. It's just, what do they call it in Japanese, in Zen tradition? Makkyo. Makkyo. And that makkyo is just this sort of stuff of the mind that really doesn't really mean anything." And so what you can do then is understand that this could be, once you're not afraid and you realize you don't have to worry about it, and you can have any kind of dream you want of any subject, and it doesn't mean anything, but you can explore them. And so to discover whether it's wish fulfillment or it's some kind of fear of the shadow, we have a dream process that we use, which is essentially, I get the person to talk about the dream in as great a detail as they can. I always tell them, like I always say, like, if when you're trying to find out which situation has hooked you the most this week, use the number from 1 to 10. And I always say that if it's 5 or less, don't worry about it. No need to put energy in it. Just, put it aside. It'll resolve itself pretty easily, or something larger will come into perspective and it'll have a domino effect in resolving it. And so, you don't have to kind of grasp after it. You can just kind of let it go. Well, likewise, I would say that with dreams, if the dream only happens once, sure, you can unpack and work with it. But I usually tell people, if you only have the dream once, it's not happening a lot, then there's probably no need to even, other than the discussion I've had with you today, to do more with it. However, if you keep having a dream, a repetitive dream, then I say to people, if you wake up, when you have the dream, wake up and try to write down as many details as you can. And then when you work with us or one of our certified teachers, the process we use is then to lay out the environment of the dream, like who's in the dream, what were the actions in the dream, etc. And then to ask yourself each part of the dream, each object in the dream, whether it's a person, place, or thing, what does that mean? And then trust your first blush. So, for example, if the person says there was a big black, I would say, "Okay, what does the big black box mean?" And take the first thoughts that come to you. And you kind of go through each object, right? And that's a very useful process because you start to see things and your mind will start to make the connections. And especially if you've been practicing meditation or mindfulness and you've been doing something like the four questions, and you absolutely will start to see things much more readily. that's one of the side effects of this practice, is you see the connections very quickly, so there's not as much confusion. Another way that you can do this is you can then look at each of those objects within the dream and ask yourself, what do I have the most attachment to in the dream? What objects am I most attached to or drawn to? And what objects that I have the most aversion to. And this also can be very helpful in helping us understand what the dream is trying to communicate or what the dream is trying to say. And it can be very useful. Again, I don't come at it from the point of view that, that you have to work with your dreams or you have to do anything with them. I think that you can do just very well without addressing them at all. You can just treat them as, an old throwback to our reptilian brain. But I think it's more than that. I think in human beings, we have this sort of self-consciousness that is so much bigger than other animals. And I think because of that, we go from not just a simple sort of, as I said, repression, but more sophisticated. So I think, I don't know if I'd go so far as Freud to say that dreams are unopened letters for us. But I would say that if a dream troubles you or is repetitive, then it might be worth unpacking and going through. And just to finish, when you do come up with the object you're most attached to or averted to, or you make connections through the other process, as you talk that out, you can apply some of the tools that we have in the four direction system. So, for example, if the object that you're attracted to is a 1 to 10, and you say it's an 8, but the object you have aversion to is a 9, then you would take that object of aversion and say, okay, what does this make me feel? What are the thoughts that are created, creating this feeling? And then take the thought apart using the four questions. So it can work very nicely. One thing you didn't ask, and I'm just going to throw this in there because it often comes up around dreams, is, or can dreams be prophetic? And can dreams have special meaning? In my own experience, I think that they can have special meaning. Well, sometimes dreams can be inspiring. And as far as whether they're prophetic or not, I'm less likely to be inclined to believe that dreams are often prophetic, because humans are very bad at prognostication, which is the fancy term for it, telling the future, what have you. On the other hand, if, like, let's say I was going to go on a trip and the night before I had a dream that something would really go wrong, I would suggest working through that. That maybe there's some unconscious fears there that you haven't addressed, and maybe you need to address them first. And again, you could ascertain that by saying, well, how strong was the dream from 1 to 10? If it's more than a 5, then you probably should unpack it. And, I have had occasions where I've had a strong premonition or dream about something, and it was a very strong number in terms of my assessment of it. And I would go through it using like the four questions. And if I found that I was just very uncomfortable and I needed to, I had to weigh, like, do I go on this trip right now at this moment, or is there enough stuff here that's bothering me that maybe I need to delay that? Then delay it. Let me give you an example. And again, I'm not saying this is anything special about me per se, but I think it's a side effect of this practice. I remember, and I've had this happen to me several times, and I always say, when in doubt, don't. Now, one example I'm going to give you is, it happened some many years ago. My son was very little, and we used to go out to this lake and spend the day, and it was quite nice. And it was a nice spring day, and we were, about halfway there, and suddenly I had this vision or premonition that a deer was going to jump out in front of the vehicle. I felt very strongly about it. And so I pulled over, and I said to my wife, I said, "I've had one of those experiences." And I said, "I really, it's really strong. What do you want to do? What do you think?" And so she said, "Well, we could turn around. We could continue forward, but maybe continue forward, maybe a little slowly, or maybe we could take a different route, see if that works." So what we did do is we just went a little slower. Right? We were in a truck, an old Ford F-150, and nothing happened. So we went to the lake, hung out on the beach, had a great time. We're coming back in the evening, and we're driving back, and I had that sensation again, that experience. And I pulled off to the road and stopped, told my wife I had that experience again, and a car went past us. We pulled off to the side. A car goes past us, and it's not more than maybe 50 yards up from us, but we're still sitting there, and a deer jumps right out in front of that car. Now, fortunately, it hit the car and kept going, so it didn't hurt anyone. But that's an example. Do with it what you will. But I found that when you enter into this type of spiritual practice, who knows what the limits of the mind are? And I certainly, wouldn't make a habit of saying, you gotta have those kind of experiences to confirm that you are on the right path, because I don't believe in that can be an ego. I do think you have to start to trust yourself. And a big part of practice for me is learning to trust yourself. So, dealing with that aspect of dreams, if someone has a dream, it doesn't mean that that dream will come true. It doesn't mean that it's truly a premonition. But it does mean that maybe, perhaps, it's saying, there's stuff you need to unpack that you haven't. Before you go into this thing, you should sort of take your time. Or it could be something that says, maybe I need to change the track I'm on here. Sort of like the multiple universe theory, or like the idea that there's different, tracks that we're on in terms of time. And if we make this decision, it ends here, but if we don't make that decision, it goes here, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a great variety of potentials out there. And this gets into, questions like quantum mechanics around Schrodinger's idea of, and multi-universe ideas, and that, maybe there's different time streams, and if you make a decision here, it's not so much that the premonition is telling you what will happen, but maybe it's getting you to think and sort of clarify what you're doing, and so maybe it'll change the trajectory of what you do, which might change the outcome. But I don't think you should allow any of these things to bother you too much. I think that basically, when you're practicing clarity, and you're working through things, when you do have these special experiences, rather than frightening you, frightening you. You learn to work with them as your puzzle that will make you even more enlightened. So I hope that was helpful, Bill. If you'd like to deal with this more, and I always say that to all my listeners, viewers, then go to my website, asksenseitony.com, and sign up for a private session with me. And some subjects we really have to do that because I can't address it completely in this format. Thank you.
You've been listening to Ask Sensei Tony. Please visit our website at asksenseitony.com, check out Sensei's books and videos, and become a part of the Dragonfly spiritual lifestyle.